Okay, good day to all our listeners tuning into the Nature Space with Hayes podcast. Today, we have the incredible honor of hosting a guest who embodies the spirit of adventure and conservation in every sense. Please welcome Sasha Dench, a fearless, and we'll come on to why she's fearless, maybe not so fearless, we'll see, Australian biologist, conservationist, and record-setting adventurer. From setting a Guinness World Record by crossing the English Channel by paramotor, we're going to find out today what a paramotor is, to a tenure with the Wildlife and Wetlands Trust, and a journey is nothing short of extraordinary. Now at the helm of the as the co-founder and CEO of Conservation Without Borders, Sasha continues to inspire us through her fearless expeditions and unwavering commitment to wildlife conservation. So without further ado, let's dive deep into Sasha's remarkable journey and her invaluable insights into the world of conservation. Hello, Sasha.
Hello.
And we're talking to you from, I'm wondering whether you can set the scene really, because you're an adventurer. So I didn't quite know where you would be today, but can you, for our listeners and viewers, just tell us a little bit more about it?
I didn't know exactly either. So I'm halfway between two places, sitting in a car with my laptop propped up on a milk bottle and a bag of mixed nuts, just so that I can speak to you today. But hopefully the signal's good enough.
Well, as a bird food company, a director of a bird food company, I feel at home that there are, you've chosen peanuts there to rest your laptop on. That's brilliant. Should we start, if it's okay with you? Can we think a little bit more about your career and this vibrant blend of, while I was looking at the research, the science, it's definitely science and adventure. Can you tell us about your early experiences and the ones that sparked this unique pathway that you've chosen and that you're on, or maybe it chose you?
Oh, gosh, I guess there's many. So my early childhood was pretty nomadic, I'd say. My parents sort of split up when I was about four, and they lived in different places. So originally it was different places in Australia. So I was moving between the coast of Sydney, where my dad was a keen spearfisher, and his idea of babysitting when I was little used to be to go off and spearfish were along the rocks whilst I was sitting in the rock pools exploring them. And then my mum moved to the bush in the very southeast of Australia, out into a place that we slowly built over time out of wood. It was a place that was kind of, we didn't really have locking doors, I don't even think. We had a can toilet that we had to empty every week and only had electricity for about an hour in the evenings. Otherwise, we had little gas lamps initially. And over time, it grew. But and then a part of my childhood was also, I would occasionally come to Europe to spend time with my grandparents. And so some of that time was living in a manor house in Suffolk, which was again very different to the Australian bush. Some of the time in Switzerland, my mum is Swiss, and our family there was involved in something called the Centre for Moral Rearmament. He'd been gifted a grand hotel with, I think it has 2,000 bedrooms, in the early 1900s. It was gifted to them as a place for refugees to go to during wartime. And it became a conference center where they'd bring people from different sides of a conflict together and have them work and live and discuss things. So I'd say it was incredibly different slices of society. I mean, I guess for lots of people would see that as being quite disruptive. I think it made me really kind of comfortable and interested in people and comfortable in kind of settling into a new place, quickly getting an idea of who's who are the influencers, what role can I play within this community, but also seeing just very different cultures, responses to nature, the state of nature. And in all of those places, though, I spent a lot of time outside. And was always fairly, felt quite self-sufficient and empowered being out in nature, which I think is also quite different to how a lot of people feel nowadays, quite separate from it.
Right. And I was thinking there, really, because when we've interviewed, obviously, quite a number of naturalists already for our Nature Space with Hayes podcast. But interestingly, some seem to herald and tell a story of how they spent so much time with nature, with animals, more than people. And what's interesting here is to hear that, you know, you've spent a lot of time with people, And I'm thinking as we talk, because what we'll come on to, if we can, about this groundbreaking journey, you know, tracking the migration of Buick swans. And it must have been absolutely awe-inspiring. And it would be great if you could share a few of those moments from
that. Not everybody sees it like that, but I'll mention that later.
Well, this is interesting, because I'm also thinking, you know, as you were talking, I'm thinking I believe from your website, you know, which we'll come on to, we'll put a link to in the show notes as well. It's sashadenge.com. But reading the notes, I'm thinking you're flying as low as potentially 100 meters. That's right. Is it a voyage that potentially on and off is lasting 3 months? And why are you doing it? Well, we'll come on to that. But I'm also thinking of the country and the landscapes and the people you must have met. And you must have come across plenty of people who said, what are you doing? So I guess in those early years, those early formulative years, you're learning how to be an ambassador and navigate your way, are you?
Yes, I guess. I think probably one thing to clarify with the people was that I was definitely an observer of people. So I was considered very shy as a kid. I was very nerdy, but I knew I changed schools many times. So I kind of figured out in every new school environment is pretty brutal. You can be picked on. I was sometimes a bit chubby, and you can get picked on a lot. So I would generally try and like be ace whatever tests there were. And suddenly I was like valuable, because for the other kids, it was like you could help us with our homework. So yeah, my feeling of meeting people was, I guess, more observing and trying to understand how different groups of people work. So it wasn't until later that I think I developed a voice and the kind of confidence to speak up. But I did, in fact, behind that, spend quite a lot of time with nature.
I see. So what happened on this journey? And I sense, you know, there's more than a few stories behind what happened.
Okay. The swan journey you're talking about.
Yes, please. Yeah, the Buick swan.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so where do we start from? I mean, do you want to start from why or the point of it?
Most things start with why. Why? I mean, I understand. You know, basically, we've lost more than a third of these swans, from 29,000 to 18,000 in a very short space of time.
Yes, we had. Okay, so to summarize lots of different things and how I ended up being asked to help with the swan situation. So my background, as you referenced, was scientific, but it was mostly genetics and of marine turtles. So I worked on sharks and turtles and things like that. But I'd slowly got more and more interested in the power, the fact that actually the skills that I could really bring to conservation was understanding and influencing people, working with great scientists, taking the data that they've collected and influencing people. So I was asked to help with this swan issue. The challenge with swans and with all migratory species is that they rely on different people, different habitats in lots of different places. So their conservation is by default always going to be complicated. You have barriers of language, barriers of culture, levels of development, amount of time and importance seen in conservation. And so they're really challenging. And I was asked to help try and figure out how to look at all the different threats we knew to the swans. We knew there were some things that we weren't seeing, because if you added up all the known threats, it didn't add up to the decline at the rate we were seeing it. And so I was essentially being asked to see how we could get people from the hunting industry, from the power line, the power companies, from farming, from lots of different industries into meetings to help us find solutions to these threats to swans. And to be honest, I looked at it all and I was just thinking, this is so complicated. And the audiences that you're speaking to have got lots of different needs. I don't think having lots of meetings is going to work fast enough for the speed of decline of this species. And yeah, I looked at this map of the birds' migration and just thought, what you need to get lots of people involved isn't to say you're part of the problem, can you come to a meeting and talk to us about it? Because people aren't going to rush at that with excitement. We need to find something that people really want to engage with. And so I thought, what you need to do is bring to life the story of their journey. And I looked at lots of different ways and eventually came up with the idea of flying with them. And I had a little bit of a precedent in that I had been flying paragliders and paramotors specifically to take aerial shots of wetlands. It was very kind of hard to un- to explain to people what a wetland does until you, except when you're looking at it down from above, you can really see how wetlands can be like kind of lungs or organs within a landscape. And yeah, so I suggested that you need to bring their journey to life. And after months, I came up with this idea of potentially flying the migration with birds. Because from their point of view, you see so much. Not only do you get a feeling for what might they be experiencing for themselves, because in a paramotor, which we haven't talked about yet, do you want me to explain what a paramotor
is? I think that would be brilliant, because I've seen this online, but for anybody who hasn't yet, they might be thinking that you're in some sort of small, unique James Bond craft. It's a lot more exposed than that, isn't it?
A paramotor has been used in James Bond film, I think, for only about 10 seconds, but it's basically a paraglider you can take off from anywhere, because on flats, because you've got a propeller on your back. So to take off, you lay it out behind you. If it's in no wind, run forwards, and then the wing will come up behind you. Then you use the throttle, get the propeller going, and that takes you up into the sky. So yeah, more throttle takes you higher rather than faster. And it obviously, that's the kind of aircraft that wasn't meant for international travel, for big journeys like this. But I had realized from flying around the UK doing aerial images, my first was over a fantastic wetland that's been recreated called Steert. I knew a few things, that if we wanted to engage with people, we needed to go to some of the remote areas to find out if there were threats to swans that we weren't seeing, or if the hunting was happening, say, up in the Russian Arctic, who was it by and why were they doing it and how would we stop it? Another key reason was to try and figure out in those communities, who are the influential people that might work with us? And lots of people thought, if you go up there, if you go flying in remote areas, particularly in Russia, you were trying to tell hunters that they're shooting the birds that you love. They're going to shoot at you. You're not going to get a very warm welcome. And I just knew that it would be different, because there is a thing with humans that if you land, and the sort of state I would be landing in after a couple of hours flying in the cold was, I'd have bad helmet hair. I'd be shivering, probably quite blue. I had snot dried in streaks down my cheeks. And people, when you land in that sort of situation, they don't look at you and go, who is this foreign huge woman coming here trying to attack us? They go, oh my god, where have you come from? Isn't it dangerous? And how can I help? And that was pretty much how we started conversations with people about helping to save the Buick swan. So in essence, that your original question was what happened on that trip. So first of all, I had to figure out how to fly, because I needed fuel for the paramotor. The first thing I had to do was figure out how to get how to refuel along that northern Russian coast. And the towns that I thought I might be able to stop at were all abandoned. And then I met an incredible man. I went up to a meeting in the Arctic, met an incredible man who offered, he's a bush pilot up there, he offered to leave some fuel drops for me in different places. And he was so influential in that community with the hunters, but also with the Nenets communities, because he grew up in one of the nomadic communities, that other people then started to step up and help. And that made it possible. Not only made it possible, it meant when at one point my engine failed at the end of when the first week of the expedition, actually, but I had help from the local reindeer breeders. Not only did they put us up for a couple of nights, they then rode me on the back of a reindeer sled for about 8 kilometers across the tundra, which was exciting/terrifying because it's flat most of the time, but you're going over a willow and all sorts of shrubs, and when there's a creek, they're very sharp sided, so there's a certain way that you have to behave on the back of a sled, and the reindeer are way more chaotic than riding behind horses or anything else. They rode me. I thought I was having to hike through the bog, basically, but they took me the 8 kilometers to the coast, where a small plane could land and bring a replacement engine. And that just sort of kept repeatedly happening again and again. Right. Like something would go wrong. You're on an expedition of this kind of scale. Mm. Every time something went wrong, people would look around. And I think there's something about people in remote communities as well, that they're very focused on helping each other, because that's the way you survive out there. And they're very resourceful, so they can make stuff out of whatever they've got around them. And that attitude was, what kept the expedition going.
So you met some great people, but I mean that point when you're on the sledge, you know, I'm getting a feeling where you must have been thinking to yourself, "What am I doing here?"
Ooh, there were lots of moments where I was thinking that. Was thinking, "What am I doing? Well, not what am I doing here?" I kind of knew what the mission was about, and I knew that people were responding to it. And it's incredible how often, like, people would say something like, "Well, they wouldn't necessarily be instantly interested in the animal that you're interested in, but they would say, you know, if you care so much, maybe I can help." So your enthusiasm can be infectious with people.
Yes.
And
So
there was moments when I was thinking, like, what am I doing here? Or it was quite often I better make the most of this because I'm probably never going to be here again, or thinking like, this is ideal for me. Flying above the Russian Arctic and the Arctic tundra is some of the most spectacular scenery I have ever seen in my life. Considering it's flat and there really aren't trees, you can see why so many millions of water birds of different species go there. I think 5 of the world's flyways all have one end up in the Arctic, and it's basically pools as far as you can see, but the colours are incredible. It's like looking at, I don't know, marble gemstones, all sorts of different colours. In fact, it's looking down from above, if there's no man-made structures, no cars, no roads, understanding scale is very difficult. So that's one of the key conversations I had with Vlad, the pilot who was dropping fuel for me, was looking at all the landscapes and going, a key thing when you're flying, whether you're a swan or you're a human, is to always know that you need where would you land if you needed to right now? And I have no idea when I'm looking down if it's, sometimes it's purple, sometimes it's green, sometimes it's white, sometimes it's orange, sometimes it's red. There's all different colors up there. Is that a place I can land, or is that wet, or what is it? And he gave me the key rule, which was, there's lots of sections which looked green, like a perfect like golf course lawn. And unfortunately, that is the sign of a bog, which would be up to about your waist.
Really?
And so he just, the one rule he said to me is was a green, no, white, yes. And white is the color of a particular, the only areas that are white are a type of lichen, and that's only growing on dry ground. So that was my kind of rule for the highway. All the other colours was kind of avoid that if you can, but those two were critical.
Wow.
So there were lots of moments where I was flying and thinking, this is incredible. I have to make the most use or remember this as well as I can.
Yes.
Because I'm unlikely to see it again, and not many other people are. We have lots of photographs of different places there. I remember giving a presentation in London to a group of female executives and showing some pictures that I was looking at it thinking, this is incredible. Like, you can see why this is amazing for birds. And it was amazing for me to see it. And the associations I had were all of wonderful things. And one of them said, God, that must have been horrible. How did you cope? And I just thought, oh my gosh, that really shows the different reference. I don't see anything horrible there. But to a lot of people, the idea of flying in challenging weather, trying to follow flocks of birds, knowing that the next place you land is going to be with strangers who are not expecting you, could be terrifying. And you don't speak the language. I spoke very basic, rudimentary Russian. I had an app, and I also had a Russian pilot some of the time.
Did there become a rule of how far behind the birds you would fly? I guess you don't want to disturb their flight path and so on. How did you research that?
I wasn't trying to fly. It's not like Fly Away Home, and it's not like any of the people that have got tame birds or imprinted birds.
Yes.
There was just GPSs that had been fitted to, I think, 12 different birds, but we followed the journeys of about 7 of them. And I wasn't trying to fly close to them at all. That wasn't necessary.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
We were using the tracks of the birds to give insights into what was happening now this year for birds. And if anything unusual happened, I would go and try and investigate further. And so, for example, when the first bird, the plan was always when the first bird left on migration, I was up in the same area. That would be my trigger to leave.
Hmm.
We used their insights, but I didn't need to fly near to them.
Yeah, you weren't looking for this Walt Disney shot of you flying at the side of them. It would be nice, I guess, would it? But you weren't looking for that.
It would be nice. So I wasn't looking for that. I did have one incredible moment. Well, I'd actually flown out to France to meet Christian Mulek. If anyone has seen on social media, there's regular clips of people flying in a microlight with someone at the front reaching out to try and pat the tail of a couple of geese that are flying in front of him. So I went to speak to him about flying with birds and just the way that they behave in relation to an aircraft. No, he has imprinted the birds. And he said he didn't think that the birds would see the lines of a paraglider. So I was concerned about that if any birds chose to fly close to me. And I did have a moment up in the Arctic where I was flying along, and it was the moment I first realized that the geese and swans actually fly together quite regularly on migration. They're not sticking in species groups at all. And I was watching this big V formation, and I noticed that two of the birds they were about 100 meters away. They're quite a distance, flying in the same direction. We were all heading towards, more or less towards the UK. And two birds broke away from that flock, and they were getting closer and closer, which is great because I could see them closer and closer. And it's incredible watching how their heads stay dead still while their bodies are flapping, their wings are flapping so energetically. And then suddenly I realized they were getting actually slowly on a converging path with me, getting closer and closer. And I remember this phrase from Christian Mulek that he doesn't think they'll see the lines. And I was really worried. So just as I was about to pull on my left brake, which basically would turn me away to the left, they basically tucked in behind my right wingtip where the vortex is, and they flew alongside me like I was the lead bird, which was absolutely incredible. So I had about 5 minutes of flying with them, and up until then I had really resisted this term, the human swan, which someone in the media had first come up with. And I was like, this is not what this is about. I mean, people. But yeah, just for those magic moments, I actually did feel like the lead bird. And I had a moment of flying close with them, but that definitely wasn't essential for the expedition. The key thing was using their tracks to give us insights into what things and I needed to
investigate. That sounds like a priceless moment there. So what were the main takeaways? What's the main insights? What did you learn from it? And how is that helping to to make it safer passageway for the swans?
I guess there's quite a lot of them. Where shall I start with? So one of the key things that we'd known for a long time was the fact that one in three living birds has got shot in their body. That's from people catching birds at Slimbridge and x-raying them. And in other places. And yeah, one in three birds have got shot in their body. And that's a pretty consistent number. So that's been ongoing. Really? We were fairly certain some of that was happening in the Arctic, and an anonymous survey had been done in a few communities. So we also knew some of the, for example, people had said, I or someone close to me is likely to have shot a swan in the last year. So we knew the sort of statistics there. What we didn't know was why, who was doing it, but also who we could influence. So a key thing that I did with the logistics of getting across the Arctic was asking the hunters to be part of the logistics team, first of all. So I asked people running hunting tourism operations up there and others to give me advice. So we had them basically allowed them to be part of a team trying to solve this problem. And as we developed a bit of trust from that, they started to come up with solutions and ideas. And I guess for anyone listening for whom hunting just is vile, up in the Arctic, there is no agriculture. So people have to live on either they eat reindeer, they eat fish, and they eat birds some of the year. But they also revere them in a way like, so for example, people have reindeer as pets, they have reindeer as transport, and they also eat them. So it is part of their life. They could not avoid it. I had hunters come up to me and ask, we had an opportunity to ask questions. Like some of them said, we know the swans are protected, but, you know, is it just because they're in fairy stories, or are they really, the numbers really declining fast? And I could show them how. And they said, but how do you actually know that numbers are declining? Because when they gather before migration, there's a lot of swans all together, and you could understand it's a sensible question. And then I can say, well, across Europe, there's so few wetlands now that we can go out at certain times of year all at the same time and count them. And being able to have like those honest conversations with them about it and not just tell them you're the bad guys. But I also had another guy come up to me showing his brochure after we had these conversations, where he'd had a picture on the front of it of a whole family sitting around a barbecue with a couple of Buick Swans on the fire. And he basically said to me, I'm really sorry, I had no idea. But we've managed to kind of get through to them in a way that was more human, and then have them and a load of other hunters get together in a meeting and say, you know, this is a problem of ours. We're the ones that should be able to fix it. So they started to, well, they formed something called the Swan Champion Network, which translates well into Russian, apparently. And they developed the program of information posters and all the rest of it, making a short film to go to hunters. So that's one way we can understand it. And the other thing that we were able to do was understand the question of, like, who are these hunters? Now, another experience was landing in a community where the mayor was actually a woman, which was a bit rare. And she dragged me up to the local school and said, you have to give a presentation to all the kids. And I asked the teacher beforehand how much the kids know about nature. And she said, oh, well, all kids up here, they start hunting when they're about 9 years old for their family before school. So that was part of. So when we're talking about hunters, we're also talking about nine-year-olds shooting animals for their family. Mm. And so you have to, it's really an insight to understand if you're trying to tackle hunting of an endangered species. You're not you might have pictured what a Russian hunter looks like, but you're also talking about nine-year-old kids. And so they're the kind of insights you can get from landing places, being very human, being quite vulnerable, because I spoke only the language only to a rudimentary fashion. We were relying on a translator and others. Making trusted allies and allowing them to be part of the kind of the hero, allowing them, I guess, to be the hero in the journey and offer to help rather than trying to beat them over the head with all your facts and statistics, which were also there as well. But I gave them the space to then ask, you know, how do you know that this is a reality?
Yeah.
I'll give you another, I guess, quite a different example, which I alluded to before. So when we got into Estonia, there was a fabulous guy that had got in touch called Heike, and he had his community had noticed that there was a power line had been developed from the mainland across to some islands. And they had noticed that from the time it was developed along a bridge, it was killing a lot of birds, mostly swans. They're the big ones that are obvious. So we're talking hundreds every year. They had started speaking to the power company and saying, look, this is not okay. They were literally being able to sort of pick them up and move them off the road. They then put out little wildlife cameras on the different pylons and managed to capture birds there. And I think they'd been built as sort of six lines high. So the power lines had six different rows of power lines. So birds, even if they saw them at the last minute and tried to divert, had a good chance of actually hitting other lines.
Yeah.
Anyway, they'd been told by the power company, sorry, no, there's no way, it'd be too expensive to bury these. And they've been told that again and again and again. And we were able to come and say, basically make a film about it, get it shown on national television, and have a meeting with the head of that power company was asked to come and give an award for the film. But we had opened a dialogue with them, and the community, from being told, first of all, sorry, we can't do anything about this. This is this is too expensive to deal with. We were able to say, actually, by having the UN ambassador for migratory birds turn up and make a big deal of it, raise their profile. And Heike sent a video some months, maybe a year or so later, saying, you know, I've got great news. First of all the lines had diverters on them. That should have been done anyway. Secondly, they had removed three of the six lines. And then he got in touch months later and said, even better news, they've agreed to bury the power lines by 2024, which is kind of a big deal considering they were being told, sorry, you know, this is too expensive. And they were a small community group of non-professional conservationists. So one of the ways, I guess, that we were able to help different people on expeditions is to find individuals who are doing amazing things. but potentially don't have the voice they need.
Yes.
And particularly I look for those who have got identified solutions and support them. And that's another key way that we're able to.
I see. Is this where the inception of Conservation Without Borders comes in? Is this the vehicle that helps yes. people collaborate and give a voice? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so I guess the whole Conservation Without Borders, the title for our organisation, came from the fact that I did decide to carry on working on migratory birds because I'm fascinated by the complexity of the conservation, but also the power of all the stories of those incredible people along the way. But I also wanted to find ways of engaging in a more meaningful way individuals out there in the world of conservation. It can be quite a, like, you know, the serious stuff is done by the conservation organizations. And as long as you can keep mm-hmm. fueling us by making donations, then we will be able to solve everything. Now, my gut feeling is they definitely, conservation organizations are doing a great job, but the job is quite big. And yes. we need people of all different skills and in different walks of life, mm-hmm. as I've seen, to step up. And sometimes it's not someone with the science or the ecology background. It's someone who understands a bit about law or who understands the hunting industry or something else. So I want to encourage people from all walks of life to be able to engage with some of the issues and have opportunities to talk about it. But I say the same with industry. I've repeatedly see a problem where the systemic issue behind the problems we're trying to solve are ones that could be solved much more easily by industry. And they're not being brought in, whether it's I want to say they're not being brought in a way that gives them a real chance to understand the problem and see how they could make a solution. Quite often it's a more simple thing of, well, we have found this solution. Can you put in some money and help us to try and fix it? I want to try and engage them much more in looking at the systemic issue. Surely you could do business in a different way, or there could be something in the system that makes this no longer happen, because conservation organizations sometimes are exhausted trying to find like band-aid solutions. So
I see.
Yeah.
So the money's important. Obviously you mentioned donations, which one of my questions really is how is this funded? Because there's a lot of moving parts, but the other thing is, what's interesting here is that the funding is important, but you seem to you want to open up dialogue and talk to, in this case, businesses, so that we can find out. I suppose we've got our politicians on one side. We know these things are going to take time, unfortunately, and we have our consumers at another side that are concerned about things. And obviously, we're a commercial enterprise. We're a bird food company. I suppose what we can do is we can move a little bit faster. We can direct our funds in a way that we can take decisions quicker, we can be a little more agile. We can pivot and all the other, you know, modern terms that have come up since COVID. But actually, we can genuinely do things and make decisions that last and do things in a different way. And so you're interested in that. Not just obviously you need the donations, I'm assuming. Yeah. Please tell us about that. But you also want the conversation as well.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I think there's probably two branches there. So we are looking at something at the moment, well, a campaign called Unstoppable. That's partly come from, in fact, a conversation with Joanna Lumley, where she was remarking at the fact that I'm walking again, despite being told after an accident I probably wouldn't. She said to me, you need to use your unstoppable nature to inspire industry to get more engaged. And so that's the model that I am looking at. So what my ideal would be that you have industry that get interested, A, in sort of putting some funds into programs, but more importantly than that, their staff are actually engaging in some of the systemic issues. So, systemic issues sounds, we often know that that's the way that we create the biggest and long lasting change, but it's not sexy. There's not one cute bird associated with it or one cute issue, or we can't necessarily guarantee that you're going to get the outcome Z, if that's the one you want. What you're looking at is trying to shift something from where it is at the moment, which is causing this amount of potential harm, and to something that's a bit better. But that's where you get the big change. And I think that systemic issues, like, for example, you know, the funding routines for power companies. It's still possible to build power lines across a bird migration flyway, as we've seen in Morocco, that are not insulated. So if you build power lines like pylons in the desert, birds of prey are migrating off it, and there's no other trees around, you will attract every bird of prey around to go and land on those pylons. And there's a pylon stretch in Morocco that kills hundreds of them. That just shouldn't happen. Funders should not, there should be a gap in the system that allows best practice to block that. So they're the kind of systemic issues that I'm talking about, and there are many associated with wetland protection and others like that. So my ideal world with companies is that we get companies involved in a way that they are collaborating more with conservation NGOs on understanding and solving the systemic issues. Because quite often when I speak to companies about problems, the solutions that, say, the marketing director or the person in the engineering department might come up with are very different to the ones that usually the ecologists within a conservation organization will come up with, because they have a different understanding of how the world works. And those collaborations are the ones I think are going to be the most powerful ones in getting us from, you know, bringing back biodiversity in general. So that's how my vision is of working with companies in the future. And then with individuals, as thank you very much for prompting that. We initially were hoping not to engage or ask for donations from people, because I'd love people to be going out there. My TEDx talk is all about us calling out to people to say, we need everybody to step up. If you can see a problem and that you can do something about, go ahead and do it. And I see loads of people like that. But we also are launching a Patreon program, which allows individuals to do similar to companies to get involved, A, in giving us a coffee a month towards the work we're doing and supporting other conservationists, but also gives opportunities to maybe understand a bit more some of the issues behind the scenes.
Yeah, we're on board with this. Interestingly, we've got a young team here that we moved from our site in Grimsby to Louth. Part of the reason we've done that is because we wanted to create this new project, which was about handing commercial space back to nature. So Ooh. We thought, look, we're a wild bird food company, and we write how people can look after, you know, birds better in their own gardens, give countryside woodland birds a space in their own gardens. We thought, hang on, it's about time we put our money where our mouth is. And what we did is, we're on an industrial estate. We didn't want to do this on a farm, because that's easy. And the farmland birds are already there. We wanted to do this on an industrial estate where there is no sign of life, really, in terms of insects and biodiversity and everything else. And we have, for example, created ponds. Our wildlife attenuation pond is going to become habitat. We've got swift boxes. And that was, we were inspired by the Swift Nest Box campaign to do that. We put swift boxes in our 7 meter eaves building, and so on. But also we wanted to make it a space where our team can connect with, stay connected with nature as well. So for example, our canteen, and you'd be welcome to come and see us one day, definitely. But canteen has a jetty that sits over a pond, so our team can take a break with nature. And that pond will gradually be, you know, we're working on planting native species and species that can create habitat as well. So we put our money where our mouth is. And interestingly enough, talking about how we can come up with better conversations and conversations more attuned to business as well, we're actually, as a team, we're all watching the Save Our Wild Isles videos, and we're actually at the moment watching The Business of Nature. Just 30 minutes, but we've committed, the whole team is watching it in segments. And we're sat and we're thinking, you know, this is our time, really. We have chosen the right time to do this. Yeah. And it's not because we've plucked this wonderful time in space in nature. It's because there really is a need. There is a gap in the market, and the gap is doing things Absolutely. In a way that's nature friendly, doing things that, you know, can put goodness back.
And I think the public are, you know, really, really hoping that's going to happen as well. I don't know if you follow ever the trust indicators or the trust surveys that come out every year on who the public trust at the moment, who they think are morally good and who they think are competent. And it's shifted quite a lot in the last 5 years and all through COVID. And now it's a case of the kind of NGOs people see as being morally having a high standing, but they are they have a kind of average competency trust, I suppose, level of trust with the public, whereas companies now are unusually are being seen as being morally, actually having not quite as morally highly yeah. rated mm-hmm. as the NGOs, but incredibly competent. And so it was partly looking at these sort of surveys that made me look at it and go, okay, so biodiversity indicators, despite the kind of people are more and more keen. I've flown all around the country in electric paramotor hearing people say, no, we're really keen. We see that something has to be done. But we still see many biodiversity indicators going backwards. And I looked at it and thought, God, imagine if those two kind of forces, the NGOs and the companies, actually started collaborating much, much more.
I think you're onto something.
Amazing yeah. places.
I think it's a great initiative. I love the sound of it. Unstoppable. We've got to be unstoppable, haven't we? Because we seem to have stopped nature in its tracks.
And our governments, with their short kind of term election schedules, waver on occasions and they flip flop a bit. And the part of us was just thinking, actually, you know, what we need those two powerful forces. As long as the two of them were working together and in the same way influencing government and saying, actually, this is happening whether you like it or not, they would also potentially have more confidence. So I think on so many levels, that's where we need to go.
Total sense. We're on board with this, with our natural capital and so on. And and it's the first time I heard those words put together. It jarred a bit because I thought, well, the natural capital, and it sounds very commercial. But actually, you know, this is, I think we've got to make decisions with nature in mind. And there's no reason why our business decisions can't be sustainable with nature in mind. Exactly. And I think to not do that, I think, is we're not interested. We are not interested in greenwashing. It would be very easy for us to, you know, to say we planted an offset and done all these other wonderful things, which I'm not belittling, but we want to get dirty. We want our nails to be dirty. We want to do it right.
Yeah. I think you've also hit the nail on the head with a few different issues. We've had for too long also a language discrepancy where conservation and scientists would go, ugh, at the idea of calling something natural capital, like using the terms. Just the different types of language have caused a problem. Sometimes when actually the outcome is the same thing, but the way of thinking about them is different. So the more that comes together, the better. But there's another thing I found. The reason that's kept me in conservation is it's so rewarding. Looking at the problems for nature and trying to solve it is exciting. That gets me, you know, it keeps me up at night sometimes. Wakes me up in the morning excited. I think that would be fantastic if we can share that more deeply with people in the private sector. There is absolutely no reason why a person in the finance department or HR can't be having as much influence as an ecologist. And I genuinely believe that because most conservation issues are all about people and the way that we do things. And I think absolutely there's benefit for conservation and for companies in engaging more and more in nature.
And when we talk about, you mentioned TEDx talks, and obviously now we're talking about commercial operations for a moment, but we're also talking about, if we can, it'd be nice to talk about, you know, some of the talks that you've given, because I can see how they can not only be inspirational and it's exciting, but I think what's great here is this opportunity to have people take this adventure or this search for adventure and sustainability, biodiversity, and some of the things we've talked about, but in their own business, you know, motivating instead of a motivational after dinner talk about how this happened and how we sold this and how we went on to do this, it would be amazing to be able to inspire companies and you know, not just directors, but you know, we have a young team here as well, you know, I feel it's my job really to open their eyes and feel that if they just repeat what we have done, what I have done, they'll only get what we've got. Maybe, the big maybe is that the conditions are changing so drastically. Getting people, COVID, for example. You know, bringing people back to work. We never stopped working, really. We worked all the way through as a manufacturer, but bringing teams into work so that they can you know, that they can feel that what they do is important, and giving them space on site so they can feel that they remain connected with nature, we think is really is important to us, mm-hmm. because that's how we will encourage them to do better work. And it's not about, you know, let's see if we can get more blood out of the stone. It's like, if we do this and we help people search and discover for themselves how wonderful nature can be, they'll come up with better solutions as well. They'll mm-hmm. write better blogs. They'll help yeah. inspire more people to help more nature. And, yeah. and that seems to me what Unstoppable seems to be from what you've said so far.
We're definitely drawing in on also the background and the attitudes of exploration, which I see as much, I think, in science as I do in the world of explorers. But there is definitely, when I speak to a lot of different companies, quite often what they are, and who I talk, some of them are looking at, you know, completely trying to reimagine their business, or at least to shift from the ways of currently doing things to doing them slightly differently, or to embrace potentially a newer arms of the business. There's definitely some elements of the world of exploration that industry can learn from. And that is, the core of it is, what is it that makes an explorer, for example, look at a mountain or a deep sea or something that everybody thinks is impossible and go, yeah, that's exciting. I want to devote lots of my time to doing that, knowing there's a high risk potentially that I might not make it. And the other element of that is, or I might not make it, but we'll at least learn something in trying. And the other thing that they seem to be able to do, and I guess I'd put myself in that bracket, is convince a lot of other people to back that idea and go with you on that new direction. How do you create that attitude within a team, which, you know, I found motivates and inspires a lot of people and from all walks of life. So that's another element that we're bringing into Unstoppable and have, you know, people like Rand Fines behind us for that. I think I mentioned before our call that he was the first person when I started talking about the flying with the swans, you know, and that's a journey that every sensible paramotorist was saying, like, there's no way, this is just not happening. Rand Fines, Sir Ranulph Fines, that is the explorer, quizzed me for a couple of hours. And at the end of it, he offered me 10 grand. And with his name and his kind of support behind it, suddenly everybody else was like, oh, maybe this is an exciting like challenge rather than a kind of a crazy idea. So yeah, all of that, the attitude and the motivation and potentially, you know, what it takes to bring a team behind you is part of our, yeah, Unstoppable.
Yeah, so admirable. And Sir Ranulph Fines as well, you know, and the interesting thing is that in a way the business community could, I mean, we are as commercial operators, we do things that this might not work, you know. And actually, I kind of quite like that feeling of being, you know, at that kind of axis where, you know, below that is boring. It's not motivational, and too much is overwhelming. But I suppose for a serious moment, you know, this might not work for me means that my marketing campaign may well fall on stony ground. You know, there's the other inherent risks of being an adventurer. And I just wonder whether, I think it was 2021, things did take, you know, a more serious turn. And I'm wondering if you could just tell us a little bit more about that. And also about how do you find the courage? Because for me, as I say, it might not work. You know, how do I find the courage to spend a little bit more on marketing? But that's flippant compared to what you've had to come back from.
Okay, so there's a few elements there. Specifically mentioned 2021 and the accident. I had my flying buddy. I'm not sure what went wrong in the air, but his propeller shredded my wing, and I fell 150 feet and onto a Scottish bog in the Highlands, and I broke all my lower legs, my hip, my sacrum, all my ribs. But for some reason, my internal organs and my spine were fine. So people that photographed it couldn't understand how I could survive that. But I have, but there are some, you know, my legs have been stuck back on. There was, I think, the worst case they've ever tried to save a pair of legs. And yeah, it's a different, I'm kind of navigating the world in a slightly different way again. But I have to say that it's the, you know, apart from incredible people that were around me, amazing psychologists, like mental health is 90% potentially of my recovery, if you even say my recovery back into the world of conservation anyway. But bigger than anything is my the inspiration to do stuff for the natural world, and that drive to have an impact, and to, you know, seeing lots of incredibly inspirational people out there that I think I can help, is, you know, is what drives me through the, you know, some of the difficulties. I had my legs in a frame and in casts for a long time. I went on the flight of the Oxbury expedition still in that state with a metal leg, and had lots of people need to help me to get around. But a part of that also, and I'd say that's the same with this idea of failure. I think probably that's the framing of what is, we're going to try this, but it might not work. One of the, let me give you an example from the Flight of the Swans expedition, where, you know, it was a couple of years of preparation, and I still was thinking, like, I had, you know, the basics of logistics, but I didn't have any permissions to fly across the Arctic. There was lots of things that still didn't work, couldn't work, might not have worked. But we were, as part of the journey of figuring out how we could cross it, I was doing, you know, practicing, making my wing collapse so that I could prove that I could survive, you know, really bad weather. I was practicing being in extreme cold. And people and media all the way from Russia to the UK started covering that story of this crazy lady that's trying to to fly with the swans. So they are already talking about swan conservation. The fact that a third of them have got shot in their bodies, people all across the flyway were already talking about it. So a part of me could say, even if this doesn't work, the original idea, people are so brought into the idea of what we're trying to do, that it is already having an impact. Not the one maybe I intended to do, would this be a failure if I don't do it? Or is this a success anyway? And we were gathering so many different people from different walks of life that were helping us. So who are also already getting involved in the journey. So I guess one thing is, it's the purpose, this idea of trying to do something to reinvigorate nature, to bring it back where we've lost it, is an idea that is so, if you can talk about it in a way that inspires people, it is a motivating force that will gather people around your mission, whether your specific project or whatever is the success that you intended in the first place. There's a really good chance that it will succeed with getting you to your mission in lots of other ways. I hope that is making sense. I mean, I definitely felt at the start of that expedition, I knew a lot of things could still go wrong, but I'd seen so many cases of where something had gone wrong in the preparation and someone out of, I don't know where, stepped up and found a solution. The guy that donated us a big tent for the expedition was the one that stepped up when I was saying, I really don't know how I get the Russian permissions, and said, my brother-in-law's something or other used to work at the Russian embassy in a remote town. You know, is this could this be of any use? And he ended up sorting out our visas for us. So these kind of things happened. Or the day that the my fixer in Russia said, you know, it's great that you've got Ranulf Fiennes and David Attenborough on board as patrons, but the Russians don't know who they are. They like their own explorers, and David Attenborough's voice is dubbed in Russian, so we don't know him. But I noticed that your last
name... That's sacrilege.
I noticed that your last name is Dench, and the Russians love James Bond. Is there any chance you're related to Judy Dench? And in the end, you know, Judy Dencher came on board as a patron and wrote us letters that ended up sorting out the permissions for the flying. So
that's incredible. Yeah.
And behind all of it was this mission. Why would she have done that if the mission wasn't trying to figure out why the swans are dying and figure out how we do something about it? So I think if your cause is strong, it's amazing what things you can do.
You were driven. You've constantly been. I think this will be coming across for anybody who's listening and watching this. You know, when we load it to our podcast, is that you can smell it a mile away. You're driven by your why and this search for meaning you found very early, and that's, you know, you've even been derailed by a serious accident. You managed to put yourself back on the track. Now, what's interesting is we've got a connection here, because you have a relation with Judy Dench, but I am not related to Judy Dench. But obviously, Judy Dench played M in James Bond, and I have in my office, I have the showreel from Maxwell Knight, who was the who was a broadcaster back in the 1950s, but actually he was the original M. He was Maxwell Knight is a the moniker M. Maxwell Knight was one of the Ian Fleming's original inspirations for that, and I've actually written quite a few pieces about Maxwell Knight and with my one of my colleagues, a good friend of mine, Professor John Cooper, and John's Maxwell Knight was his mentor. So I've got a few things actually. I've got his little observation kits and things where and his where he would that he had in his bug room. So I'm not related to the original M, but I kind of feel I am. I even have his old filing cabinet actually.
Let's be very clear. My connection is not close. My great great grandfather is her great grandfather, but I'm from the illegitimate wife, the second wife who was Bessie from Battersea.
But we have a link. We have a link now. We can share that link. We have connections here. Can we talk a little bit about the Osprey expedition? Because that sounds amazing. What you know? Just how do you summarize this in a few moments? But we'll send a link to it in the show notes. But what happens there?
Oh, I mean, maybe we do a whole nother podcast on it.
We can do that.
And we made a series for Radio 4 about it. I think that's the key thing. Obviously, with this expedition, I couldn't fly, so we were using drones to look at the sites from the air. But yeah, we followed four GPS tracked birds down into Africa and watched their exploits: three juveniles and an adult bird. And use their tracks, their movements to get insights into all the different threats to birds. We're looking at, as I mentioned before, the direct ones. I think we found 38 of those just in this year alone. And if you bear in mind that the year we flew, it was we traveled with them. Sorry, there were extreme fires and droughts all across Europe. So it was a pretty nasty time. We think we found 38 direct threats, and about 20 kind of systemic issues behind that, and met some really brilliant people from different walks of life, as I expected, who were stepping up to do something about it, whether that's campaigning or coming up with solutions. In the UK, there's a woman that really inspired me called Gail, she works at Glaslyn or volunteers at Glaslyn in Wales. I think she's a speech therapist or something like that. And the first thing she did was, after watching our osprey nests, I think it might have also been after the nest was chainsawed down, decided that she wanted to do something active as a positive response to that. And she first decided to swim a river to raise money for one of the local efforts. And then one of the local birds called Jimmy was electrocuted on a power line, and pylons electrocute a lot of ospreys, particularly if they land with a dangling fish. You can cross the lines, and that's where the problem occurs. And so as a volunteer with no biological, ecological science background, she went out of her way to contact the power companies and highlight the issue to them. But then once they had a meeting with her, which many people would think, oh, look, why would anybody listen to me? But they do. If you come with a story, quite often you will get an audience. And they spoke to her. And then at the time she said, look, I'm not only interested in sorting out this one power line, look at the whole of Wales. So these are the movements of ospreys around Wales. Everywhere where your power lines are crossing lines that ospreys are using, all of those power lines should be insulated. And she's had a huge impact. And that's from, one person. She did pull lots of information together and talk to people, but not a professional kind of conservationist, but someone with, attitude and enthusiasm. And we just met many people like that along the way. Some really serious issues and, great people working on those sites specifically. But the area, like I've said, where I think we can have most impact is at the systemic issue. And I'll give one other example of why I think involving industry in a more industry and the private sector in a more engaged way is that I go to UN conventions where I speak as an ambassador. And I remember clearly the first one where there were, I think, 3,000 people there all talking about different threats to birds. And most of them involve industry behind the scenes, but there were no industry representation there. And when I asked, how do we then engage industry in pulling apart these issues, that was not a core part of the plan. I think a lot of people assume that it is. There's bits and pieces going on, but it is not part necessarily of the bigger UN processes. And that's where I think we really need to engage more.
That's it. So this is the COP26.
That's the climate COP I'm talking about. There are various different COPs and MOPs.
So just
around
the right. Okay. Well, that's funny, isn't it? Because you would think that would be on the table and be a given, but you just identified that it's not.
It is not. So in some, so there are some initiatives that have industry involved, but just the way that the UN system works, I'm simplifying horribly, and there are great people.
Yes.
doing their best within it. But in order for it to work, you need as many countries to agree and be involved. And quite often they don't have legal teeth. They need to voluntarily agree to be a part of things and to sign things. So by default, they don't have many teeth. And they also then are less obliged to be quite aggressive or put the effort into saying, actually, this country on the flyway is potentially a massive problem. We really, really need you to do this. You can't just say, yes, it would be nice. The wording of the documents is normally, it would be very nice to consider if all power lines should be insulated. There isn't really a vehicle to say, actually, this area, this problem is causing the death of thousands of birds. And potentially, you know, for stretches of Morocco, I'm going to be honest here, it's a third Morocco plus what was Western Sahara that they've now annexed, if you call that, it's a third of a flyway. So it's a core part of the survival of many of our migratory birds. There isn't really the mechanism for anyone to go in there and say, look, really, how do we look at the whole industry and figure out how we solve this? That role kind of falls in bits and pieces to different NGOs. Yes. The ones in Morocco have very little political kind of power. So the more help we can give them, the better. But it's not until you sit back and try and look at the whole system and go, actually, is it government or is it the system of the royal family? Because they have some ownership and power. Or is it industry, which much of it is actually foreign? Where do we best put the impact? And that's where we think collaborations with industry are the way we solve those problems.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. Well, we're nearly at the end here because I'm worried about that bag of peanuts that you might be feeling a little peckish yourself. And now you've got a question whether you attack the peanuts or continue chatting. So I think we've taken enough of your time if we can. But I wonder whether I think it would be wonderful if our listeners and amongst them will be our young team here really want to tap into that explorer mindset that you're kind of opening a little window and illuminating for us. But what message I guess would you like to leave us as individuals or us as a business? I think you've mentioned some of this already, but I suppose if we can wrap it up into a takeaway message just to inspire us to make a little bit more of a positive impact on nature, and the floor is yours if that's okay.
Gosh, that is so broad, depending on who I'm speaking to as individuals. So first of all, I think it's very true from my experience of meeting a lot of people in a lot of different places. Where most of the change happens is an individual standing up and deciding to, like, noticing a problem and deciding to do something about it. But it's quite often not necessarily just that person. That person is a lone kind of potential kind of nutter with a mad idea until someone else steps up and tries to back them. So even if you're not the kind of person that will necessarily notice what's going wrong or have a solution, if you've got a skill that can help them, then please, like, don't hesitate to be the person that backs somebody who's currently the lone voice, because they might be the start of a movement which really drives change. That's, I guess, on an individual level. And as my TED talk was all about, the fact that scientists and environmental organizations have been great at identifying the problems, at monitoring, how things are declining, but we need people from all different walks of life to help solve them. So that is a key thing. Can I be really challenging on the kind of corporate and company front?
Please do.
And I guess it's part of our unstoppable idea is that we think that now is a time that, and maybe you've already done it, that every company should take some time out, whether it's just a few key people, whether it's people at the top, whether it's people throughout, to take a moment out in what various people have called a kind of imaginarium, and ask yourselves for a moment, big blue sky thinking, if your core aim of your business was not only to kind of make money, but was to assist with the regeneration of nature. What would that look like? And for a moment, like, ditch the financial realities of it. What could that look like with your skills and what you, the area you work and what you do? And then have a look at how can you make that financially viable? And I think if every company tried for that, because in reality, that is the only way that we solve this, the current ecological and biological crises that we're in, is if all of the players within it decide to come together. And that's the way we do it most efficiently. What could that look like? If we don't at least to try and imagine that first, then we're never going to get there. And that's what it's like with expeditions. You know, I have a mad idea. I want to fly with the Buick Swans from A to B. It's ridiculous right now. But once you start saying it, then slowly bits and pieces fall into place and you go, actually, you start to notice solutions Yes. or ways that you might get there. So I guess I'd say take some, if you dare, take some time out to go through an imaginarium of what could our company look like if that was a core aim of all of us and the company, as well as being financially viable. What would that look like? And it might look like what you've got now, but it might look quite different.
Yeah, I love that. If you dare. My feet are trembling already. I think we dare. That's the thing. We dare. We not only will we dare, but I will feed this back to you. And as I say, I will send, you're very welcome to come and see us so you can hold us to account. But I think we dare. And I think you've inspired us as well. And I think I can see, you know, I always think about my mom, for example. You know, she's a small garden. She feeds the birds. But we talk about this all the time, you know, about how our next door neighbor and the next door neighbor after that are this stepping stone for nature. And I think, but there will be somebody there in her community who is worried about a hedge perhaps being ripped up, you know, but he or she is maybe not sure how and what they can do about that. But as collectively, they can have a voice. Get behind them, you know, let's fight for that hedge because it makes a difference.
And share it with enough people and you will find people, you know, some people will go, actually, I've got a completely different solution for that. But yeah, getting a team of people behind you, and you probably find more people care than you think. I mean, I guess that's more and more obvious these days, but that's certainly what I have found.
Well, I'm going to say goodbye and I'm going to say that the unstoppable Sasha Dench, it's been unstoppable, more than just, you know, more than just what you're doing. I think you are unstoppable, but I think I think it's been wonderful chatting with you, and I'm sure our listeners will have enjoyed that too. So thanks ever so much. Good luck with everything, and I hope to see you here, and perhaps we can have a follow up about the ospreys and so on at some point.
There's plenty. I hope
Thank you. Until then,
bye bye.